I want to talk about the threat in the second half of this century that could reverse all the very encouraging signs and progress we've seen in reducing maternal and infant mortality this morning. Let me begin with the Sahel. Sahel in Arabic means shore. It's that dusty, dry area on below the Sahara. It's an ecological zone from the Atlantic to the Red Sea. In 1950, there were 30 million people. We're not evolved, really, to think about big numbers. 30 million is about as many civilians and combatants were killed in World War II. Today, there are 102 million people. By 2050, there could be 340 million people in this ecologically vulnerable zone, where 90% of people are pastoralists or subsistence farmers, where women are treated in atrocious ways, where education is minimal, and where there's a great deal of violence, where an Al-Qaeda clone has taken over half of Mali and is busy stoning women who have sex to death. By the year 2100, there could be 600 million people in that area. That is clearly implausible. Demographers are reluctant to make projections after 2050, but many of the women who will be having children at that time are already born. And in Niger, 20% of women have 10 or more children. And there are only two things that could change that projection of 600 million people in this area by 2100. And that is rising mortality or falling fertility. Now, those are rather threatening numbers, but now take into account another factor. I have a colleague in the Lawrence Berkeley lab who is on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he has a supercomputer. I said, Michael, can you run some projections for the Sahel? And by 2050, the temperature in the Sahel will go up 3 to 5 degrees centigrade. And by 2100, 8 to 10 degrees centigrade. Crop yields begin to decline very rapidly after about very near the temperatures that we'll get by 2050. The camels will die and the crops will wither. There will be no food production in the Sahel by 2100. There will be the biggest forced migration in human history. So that climate change in these areas can turn a population crisis into an unprecedented humanitarian disaster. I think all of you are familiar with population pyramids. This is for Niger. You can hardly see it in 1950. Today it's getting a bit bigger. By 2050, it's astonishing. And by 2100, the fact here is that this is an optimistic projection. This is a projection by the UN Population Division. And the UN Population Divisions assume that by 2100, everyone will have 2.1 children and live happily ever after. There is no evidence base for that conclusion in certain parts of the world. Climatologists and even people in public health tend to look at the median UN projection and then ask what is the next question. But all the UN projections are no more or less plausible than each other. And even in this projection, we've got half the world with replacement level fertility. We've got a large part of the world between 2.1 and 3 or 4 children, places like the Philippines, like Kenya, who with sensible policies could go to replacement level fertility. And then we've got these high fertility countries, these least developed countries. There are 48 least developed countries in the world. They were identified in the 1960s and 70s. Only one of them, with more than 1 million people, and that's Botswana, has graduated from being least developed to developing. If we look at the high projection, these least developed countries go to almost as many people as there are on the planet today. These are the countries where there's not going to be skilled birth attendants. These are the countries where the absolute number of women dying in childbirth could well roll back everything that we have achieved. We could go to a lower population, 6.2 billion. These least developed countries will still be the largest absolute number of people. Hanya Slotnik, who's just stepped down from being the UN Population Division, recognises how important the variables are in these projections. And the key variable really is the rate at which countries are increasing their contraceptive prevalence. Now, those of us like Richard Derman and myself and other people in this room that have worked in 40 years in this field know that in Asia we're able to raise contraceptive prevalence by about 2% a year in quite a lot of cases. That is, if it was 12% use of modern contraception last year, it was 14% this year and 16% next year. So, with a very clever PhD student and stimulated by my wife's idea, we said, let's compare two countries. Ethiopia is now 85 million people. It's really making a lot of investment in family planning. It is task shifting in ways that we've heard. It is teaching community workers to give safe injectables. It's doing medical abortion. And the contraceptive prevalence rate is rising by over 2% a year. And they, by 2100, if they continue to do that, and that's a challenge, will have 163 million people. That's doubling the population of the country that's already pretty poor. That is a challenge. But they might get somewhere. Niger, contraceptive prevalence has been increasing by 0.5% a year. And if they continue with business as usual, they reach 567 million people in 2100, which is clearly absolutely implausible. The only way that can be changed if they don't increase their contraceptive prevalence is by rising infant mortality and probably by more conflict. So we really do have a challenge. Those least developed countries like Bangladesh and Nepal we've heard about today that already have low total fertility rates may well, I would expect them to graduate into the developed country level. But most of these countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, Chad, the Central African Republic, Yemen, Afghanistan, are not going to get there unless we do something very, very forceful. So at the present moment, these least developed countries, the ones we don't like to go to, everything we've heard about today is in the safari countries, as I call them. You know, the easy ones. My colleague in this room, David, has just come back from northern Nigeria. In Kaduna, there was a suicide bomber blowing up people in the Catholic Church. This is a dangerous area, and I congratulate David and other people that have the courage to work there. The window for opportunity for doing anything in healthcare in these countries is closing. So if we take the low UN projection, they become about 45% of the total population in 2100. And if we take the high projection, they come about 39%. So these are the areas. If we believe that all people are equal, and if we believe that the death of a woman in Mali is as painful as the death of a woman in California, then these are the places where we have to put our attention. These, again, are graphs that my wife stimulated a design. This is not high, medium, and low population numbers. It is what happens in Niger if they reach replacement level fertility in 2020. So they're currently at 16 million people. If they reach replacement level fertility in a few years' time, which of course they won't, they would go to 30 million. If they delay till 2040, they go to 50 million. If they delay to 2050, and they're not even on a trajectory to do that, they go to over 70 million. So there is an urgency which cannot be overemphasized. In 1994, there was an international conference on population development in Cairo. After that, budgets for family planning collapsed. And one of the things that happened, we now have this huge population momentum in the least developed countries, which we cannot reverse. Martha and I were privileged to go to the London Summit on Family Planning on July the 12th in London, when the British government and Melinda Gates made a commitment to get family planning back centre stage. And that was a very exciting event, very poorly reported in this country, but a very, very important one. If we continue the business as usual scenarios, then all we've achieved in global health in the past 50 years could be rolled back in a tsunami of unintended pregnancies in the least developed countries. We have a choice. And it's a choice that we must make quickly, to invest significant sums of money in family planning. And in these least developed countries, which like Afghanistan or Niger or northern Nigeria where we're working, which have a very low mean age of marriage, where David's working is 14 and a half years. So some girls are getting married when they're 12 years old. Those girl brides, in my opinion, are a human rights abuse that is totally unacceptable. They have 3 times the maternal mortality of mature women and twice as likely to be beaten by their husbands. We have to do something to keep those girls in school. And David and the people with him are succeeding in doing that at $28 a year. We have to prorate that out. We had a meeting on the Sahel in Berkeley last month. And there were people committed to working with children, the climate experts, the family planning experts. And there was a man from the Defense University in Washington, National Security, Colonel Thomas Dempsey. And he said, the most important thing you can do to reduce conflict in the world is to invest in women. And I think that's a message that everybody can and must adopt. We're in a very threatening situation. And what happens in the second half of the 21st century is decided today. You cannot reverse population momentum. We can continue to make progress, or we can throw it all away, and now is the time we make the decision.
Somehow we've been managed to catch up. I just want to make one concluding remark. I think you'll agree with me with the presentations made by our distinguished panelists. They were just wonderful. Malcolm, of course, in his own visionary way, has projected problems that we do need to address. But since this is a global conference, not just the international health area, it's important to say, as we look at all of these, and we often look at the U.S. as the mecca of healthcare, please remember we're 39th in maternal mortality. We spend twice as much in healthcare as we do in Norway and Switzerland, with nowhere near the same results. So we shouldn't look at the U.S. We need to look at Italy. We need to look at Scandinavia as the models upon which we compare the future of our programs going forward. So I know that we've utilized all of our time. I want to thank the panelists, but let me just share that everyone will be here to answer questions one-on-one. Thank you for your attendance.